In what sense did Jesus die for my sin? Welcome to Prologue. We continue our discussions on the cross, story of redemption. Conversation partners are again Paul Dibdahl and Larry Vavirka. And I would simply like to pick up a piece that we began talking about last week, where Paul mentioned that in Luke, resurrection is much more important than the cross event, and that blood atonement for Luke plays almost no role at all. Now, did I set you up in the right way there, Paul? Can you come back
now,
and correct that?
Before Paul responds, I want to do a little clarifying. So I was listening to you, it just sounded to me that you were going to another New Testament author who is going to do something with Luke.
Yeah, this would be a different Paul speaking here. Let there be no mistake about that. And I've forgotten kind of your question. Kind of summarized where we ended last week, and I think the summary was very close.
Well, what I wanted to get at, and it's interesting that Larry called me to account here, because clearly when you go to Paul, especially Romans and Galatians, you get a powerful emphasis on the atoning power of the blood, substitutionary atonement. But what you had called us to our attention was that in Luke, you don't have that kind of emphasis, that the emphasis is more on the resurrection.
Luke, who is responsible for about one-fourth of the New Testament, I don't think he's real interested in various theories of the atonement, maybe in the same way that we are, because for him, the focus, the good news, is the resurrection. Yeah, I think that's the case.
Now, could you help us to define the focal point of the Christian message, then, in such a way that views of the atonement do not become the turning point, become dividing points?
Well, I think just the fact that you have in the New Testament so many different ways of looking at the death, the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus, and different authors focus on different aspects of it. Even those authors who focus on the cross will see some different things there. And I think that's probably where we're headed. And as we see that diversity in Scripture, I think that's important for us as we talk about the issues today, for example, in the church, that we recognize that we may each be naturally drawn to something that our neighbor may not be drawn to. We may experience the cross from different perspectives, and I think that should be okay.
Now, and I'd like to get Larry some feedback on this too. I had a student responded to me, and he happens to be very much focused on the substitutionary atonement. He said, you know, this idea of diversity is marvelous, but how can you do that with the cross? See? Now, I think what you point out, James, for example, doesn't mention the cross at all, the sacrifice, and you have Luke, Acts, where it's placed very low profile, but you do have Paul. So the fact that the Spirit has brought all of those together in one book, does not that diversity suggest that we ought to allow a similar diversity within the church? Larry, could you give me a response to that?
Well, the first thing that occurs to me is that you who have written a bit on inspiration know that there are two ways of looking at what we find in Scripture. I mean, if God is the single author, and God is responsible for its content, then the whole point of diversity is a moot one. But the facts are, even if you hold that particular perspective and you read Scripture, there are different perspectives. And I don't care which side of that inspiration fence you're on, somehow you've got to allow for that, it seems to me. And to be able to talk in multiple ways with, it's like looking into the same room through different windows. And in the process of doing that, you see the central event, but you see it through different lenses, different hues, shades. You see it from a different angle and can describe it differently. And all of those views, all of those ways of looking at that are correct.
But what is it that makes people get so uptight about allowing a different perspective? Is it that they're afraid that the person with that different perspective is going to impose his or her view and take away that which is precious? Is that the nature of things? I think I begin to hear noises like that.
Yeah, on something which is so personal. I mean, it really is. This is the central kind of issue here. Mm-hmm. Issues of, you know, our personal salvation and on those very personal, deep kinds of issues, when we experience them in a certain way, I think it's more difficult for us to imagine that someone else doesn't share maybe our same experience. Does that even make sense?
Mm-hmm. Well, and I do think there is this sort of conviction that there's only one way to look at something, and if you're not seeing it that way, that you're wrong. I mean, it's that sort of monolithic unifocus that doesn't allow for other perspectives. So when you talk about other perspectives, if you talk about diversity of viewpoints, you're challenging that particular vision.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I think, too, people maybe are just afraid. You know, we start talking about options and different perspectives and all that. I think you do. There is a concern that, well, does just kind of anything go? You just believe whatever you want to, and that's all okay.
That was precisely my concern, Paul, and you put it nicely.
And I think there is that danger. I suppose we could head in that direction.
It doesn't make any difference what you believe. We're all going to heaven anyway, and that's, I think, a rather deadly way
Absolutely.
To go.
I
like to think of it as a motivational focus. And I don't know where I picked up this illustration, but if you've ever been to the eye doctor, and I think, Paul, you've never been, right?
No, I had horrible eyesight, but now I can see clearly. There's quite a story there.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Anyway, but what intrigues me, when you go to the eye doctor, you go and he holds this, does it work better this way or this way?
Yeah.
And I like to think of the biblical perspectives. You know, do you need more Paul? Oh, maybe too much Paul. How about John? You know, James, maybe some Lamentations. You know, Jeremiah. See, the moral of the story is you want everyone to see, but everyone has a different set of lenses.
Yeah, you're looking at the same thing. You're trying to see the same thing.
Yeah.
My problem with the eye doctor is it all looks the same to me, so particularly those little fine-tuning things, you know, driving me nuts.
Well, isn't that you can take that parallel, though. When you talk with someone and you try to put a word in their mouth, no, that's not quite right, see? It seems like it's perfectly good to us, but the other person says, no. So, in fact, I think one of the marvelous ways of carrying on debate, Marcus Borg, who is a liberal New Testament scholar, I saw him in conversation at a major convention with a conservative, and I don't know, it may have been N.T. Wright, may have been someone else, but I thought it was such a marvelous illustration. Borg would say, now, let me see if I properly understand your position. And only when the other person said, yes, that is a fair representation of my position, then you could carry on the conversation. But what we tempted to do in so many of these conversations, we use nothing but and only and caricature the other person's position. The other one says, no, you don't have it right. See?
Well, I try to teach couples to do that. You only win the right to respond when you can correctly characterize the other person's statement.
Yeah, it's a marvelous lesson in communication. And it seems to me so very obvious that in the Bible we have difference of perspectives. All you have to do is look at the concordance and go looking for the names. And it's a deadly giveaway when someone who has been either a legalist or a brand new Christian, when they gravitate to Romans and Galatians. That's all they'll read. Romans and Galatians, Galatians and Romans, more Romans, 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 as if they were trying to convince themselves. See? And other people will go to John. See? So I think that diversity is really terribly important. But let's talk a bit about the meaning of substitution, because clearly our lesson book, you know, emphasizes substitution. Why is that so powerful? I'll admit that I've had to work at substitution to make it meaningful. I think it's beginning to happen. But why is it so powerful for some Christians? Well, maybe I should ask you two, on a scale of 1 to 10, how important is substitution in your personal experience? Is that a fair question?
Well, as I think of that question, there's almost a kind of progression for me. I think the good news was first framed in more Romans, Galatians terms. Mm-hmm. But as I have grown in my walk with Christ, as my own understanding of God has deepened, I've really found much, much more power in what God is doing, is making the most ultimate, incredible statement of love that he possibly can in the cross, which has captivated my heart. I haven't had to have the sort of logical explanation necessarily that I did initially. It's much more, and I would think in some respects it ought to have been the reverse. But I know in my own experience, I start with that sort of mechanical understanding and then moved far more to an all-embracing statement of love.
Mm-hmm. Paul, where does substitution fit? Is it?
I heard all my life, you know, Jesus died for my sins, mm-hmm. and believed it. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't until I took a sanctuary class in the seminary and we spent most of the quarter just talking about the sacrificial system of the Old Testament. And as I kind of immersed myself into that mindset, it was then that for the first time, what I'd said, you know, Jesus died for my sins, for the first time began to make sense to me. The whole idea, again, which I had mm-hmm. known, but which I had not really felt before, and that's when it really became meaningful to me, was when I more clearly understood the Old Testament background mm-hmm. and what the Jews at that time, you know, would have felt culturally. They were accustomed to that whole idea of substitution. Mm-hmm. I think we have to work at it to really understand it at a deep level today.
One of the things that has concerned me, and I think here particularly of Maxwell Pravancha, who plays a very strong emphasis on the family model, which is not strongly substitutionary, and many of those who follow Maxwell actually are pretty hostile to substitution. I think Graham tends to be fairly careful. But the tendency to say that if we are really mature, then we'll grow out mm-hmm. of the substitutionary. Mm-hmm. And that I find very troubling, because if there's anything that is destructive of Christian fellowship, is to be condescending mm-hmm. and say, well, yeah. if you could see things as I see them, then everything would just be fine. And I don't know what experience you've had, and we won't have time to explore this, but I think Kohlberg's level of moral development and Fowler's levels of spiritual development are deadly when it comes to trying to discuss diversity, because it sounds so condescending.
Yeah.
And so I would hope that it would be a both-and approach. Different people have different perspectives, but one is not superior mm-hmm. to the other. So I think that's very important. Now, we'll have a chance, you know, I've chattered away too much here, and we'll have a chance to come back to this, because next week we talk about justification, and you men will be on board, so we'll continue that conversation. Thank you very much. My thanks to Susan Michael, our program engineer, and to all of you for listening in. For Probe, I'm Alden Thompson.
You've been listening to Probe, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla College and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194 or email us at probe@wwc.edu. Thanks for listening. We'll be here next week at this time with Probe.